left is mirroring that which it wants to defeat and criticize in its form of organization. What we should really do on the left is smash the mirror. Imagine things are not just simply like neoliberalism with a left tilt. We have to think about something which is kind of, you know, radically, radically different. And this is a moment when I think some of that imagination can occur.
That's David Harvey, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features David Harvey. Smash the Mirror, Imagining a Different System. The global health and economic crises are points of opportunity. Arundhati Roy, the great Indian intellectual and writer, says, "Whatever it is, coronavirus has made the mighty kneel and brought the world to a halt like nothing else could." And in the midst of this terrible despair, it offers us a chance to rethink the doomsday machine we have built for ourselves. Nothing could be worse than a return to normality. Historically, pandemics have forced humans to break with the past and imagine their world anew. This one is no different. It is a portal, a gateway between one world and the next. We can choose to walk through it, dragging the carcasses of our prejudice and hatred, our avarice, our data banks and dead ideas, our dead rivers and smoky skies behind us. Or we can walk through lightly, with little luggage, ready to imagine another world, and ready to fight for it. The words of Arundhati Roy. Our guest today is David Harvey. He's a distinguished professor of anthropology and geography at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. He's the author of many books, including The Anti-Capitalist Chronicles. This webinar, organized by Haymarket Books, was recorded in mid-November. The moderator was Umba Akbar, law professor at The Ohio State University. And now, David Harvey.
I think it's very important to try to separate out what was there already and what the virus has done. I mean, there are certain specific things, obviously, that come from the impact of the virus. And it may be that the virus has done us a favor in the sense that it stripped bare a lot of the bankruptcy of the neoliberal kind of governmental project, which is essentially to take the government out of the support of the population, to privatize social welfare through the NGOs and all the rest of it, and essentially to not prepare to protect the whole population. That project has been going on for a very long time. It is not about getting government out of the economy. In fact, the government in many ways is back into, always has been back into the economy in big ways, in cahoots usually with big capital. One of the symbolic sides of that is that nearly always the Secretary of the Treasury in the United States has come from Goldman Sachs, and that's been the case since the 1990s. And in a sense, the whole kind of economy has been managed in public-private partnerships, which is the general strategy of which is that the private takes the profit and the public bears the risk. But now the bankruptcy of that, I think, is being revealed pretty much everywhere through the impact of the virus, and something has to be done, clearly, in terms of restructuring the positionality of the state in relationship to the economy. The ruling class, I think they see this as a point where probably they have to, for a variety of reasons, launch into a strategy of reform. And actually, in U.S. history, and if we just confine ourselves to the United States, there have been these quite dramatic reform periods, like the New Deal, like the Progressive Era, like the sort of 1960s. And I think that people see, for two reasons, that they need to reconfigure the way in which state and capital are working together. And I think the two reasons are quite simply that the legitimacy of the system was already under question. I mean, if we look back at the struggles that have been going on, not only in the United States, but all around the world, all the places where there were semi-uprisings going on almost everywhere, clearly the economy is not working in a way where people feel that it is okay for them. And clearly political governance is not working in a democratic kind of way. So I think that the ruling elite are recognizing that, and explicitly so. I mean, I look at Governor Cuomo in New York, for example, who kind of says, we can't go back to what we were doing before. We've got to take care of a whole bunch of issues. They know that their legitimacy is in question, and they have to do something about that. I think in this last election, the reliance upon, for instance, the black vote and the Hispanic vote and the reliance upon the vote of all of those people who've borne the brunt of this pandemic is clearly now there has to be a kind of a political answer on the part of ruling elite to all of that. So I think that's very much on the cards right now, that we're going to see a period of bourgeois reform that is going to address the symptoms, but it's not going to go to the root causes of the situation. I think the same will apply to environmental politics and the like. So I think there are going to be all kinds of gestures along those lines from a new administration. But there's an interesting question, which is, it's very striking to me right now that 72 million people voted for Donald Trump. 72 million people. That's a hell of a lot of people. And they are, for the most part, I think, probably convinced that Biden is not a legitimate president of the country. So this is a very unstable moment to be talking about this. But as I say, I think it was pretty clear around the world, not only in this country, and in fact, in other parts of the world, probably even clearer than here, that the economy is not organized in such a way as to deliver health and well-being and a reasonable standard of living to the mass of the population. And governmentality is a shambles and it needs to be reformed. And that was on the cards earlier in the year. And I think we were up for something of that direction, but the pandemic has emphasized that.
What do you think are the primary contradictions of capital now? And if you can just explain, why do you think it's important for organizers, activists, and social movements to kind of identify those as we kind of think about what to fight for and how to fight for it?
Well, when I was writing about the contradictions, I had three serious contradictions. One is the infinite growth that is implicit in the fact that profitability is about an expansion. So the system has to expand so that perpetual growth forever has been running into barriers. And I think over the last 40 or 50 years, we've seen some of those barriers emerge. There's been a big problem for capital to find new spheres to invest in. If you look at the situation in 1970, it was still the situation that China and the Soviet Union and the Soviet Empire were not part of the system. They've now been integrated into the system. We've now got, for the first time in history, a genuine situation where the whole of the world is, in effect, enfolded within the capitalist dynamic. And the capitalist dynamic says there has to be 3% compound growth forever. But where can that growth occur? When Marx was writing, capital was established in a very small part of the world. It was mainly sort of Western Europe, Britain, and the eastern seaboard of the United States, and the whole of the world was still to play with. Well, the whole of the world has now been brought in. We've now got a huge increase in the global wage labor force from something like 2 billion to 3 billion. Where's the labor force expansion going to come from? Where's the market going to expand? All of those kinds of questions which capital was facing and was already facing, I think, over the last 30 or 40 years. So this infinite growth problem is a very serious one. And of course, the only form of capital that can grow without limit is the money form. Actually seen a huge expansion of the world monetary system, which generates all sorts of questions as to what's that money going to do. And of course, a lot of it has gone into assets rather than into production. So we've got a lot of speculation in land and property. We've got speculative activity in all sorts of spheres. So the infinite growth is still there, and there's no way that's going to be solved within the framework of capitalism, because it just cannot continue that way. So that's the first stress. And what we've seen over the last few years is capital finding all kinds of new ways to absorb the infinite growth. The second, which is connected to that, is, of course, the environmental stresses. And now, environment has always been a problem, but it's usually been localized. We've now got a global situation with climate change, degradation, species extinctions, and all kinds of questions of that sort, and use of land, which is not infinitely expandable. So the environmental question is there. And the third big contradiction was what I call universal alienation. And I think that more and more, that is actually something that which is being, I think, emphasized through the pandemic, is the fact that many people feel alienated from an economic system where they're not getting enough food, they're not getting enough support, they're not getting enough adequate housing. Nothing's sort of working. So there's a big sort of distrust now of the economy, and of course, a big distrust of government, because a lot of governments have failed. The three basic contradictions which have been underlying this are still present in many ways, emphasized by the pandemic, as opposed to sort of something completely new emerging. The deaths in African American, for example, and also in the Latinx community, you know, all of that is a very important component part of what we have seen. But at the same time, the people who've kept the economy going in the physical kind of sense of keeping it going, like the people in the grocery stores and services, they come from that background. And in a funny kind of way, one of the things that's happened is that we've got a very clear redefinition of class. Now, my definition of class is it's not a fixed category. And I always think this is true of the way Marx sets it up. It's not a fixed category. It's constantly in transformation and motion. And I think that one of the transformations that occurred was a redefinition of class through the response to the virus. And if we ask the question, who are the people who are, if you like, the working class? They are the working class. And when you look at who they are, you see immediately the configuration of the population that formulates that working class. If we want to understand how class has been reconfigured in the United States, one of the places in which I think you will see that would be in an airport. And I thought to myself, when as you go out of the airport, you look out and the people who are getting the plane running and moving the luggage around and all that kind of thing, and you look at the constitution of the population, and you see immediately that basically it is African-American, Black people of color, immigrants, and waged women. And you kind of say, that is the new working class. But at the time, I was kind of saying, if the new working class is going to get organized, then one of the ways they could do it is to actually organize the airports. Imagine if all the airports got closed down. And actually, well, I mean, that would bring the United States to a stop in a very short time. I always remember after the 9/11 attacks, about 4 days afterwards, people were pleading for us not only to get out our credit cards and go shopping, but also to get back and start flying again. So the working class was already being redefined, I think, by that collection of people who run an airport. And they have a tremendous kind of power. And you say to yourself, well, suppose all of a sudden they all have said they're not going to go to work today. And after about a week, I think there will be a total chaos and the political system would have to surrender. And during this pandemic, what we've seen is that sort of configuration of class being redefined in a certain kind of way. And that is the class, if it decides and has a collective presence and becomes, quote, when Marx uses this concept of a class in itself and a class for itself, now we have a class in itself, which has been defined by this pandemic and was defined by the airport kind of example. If that class becomes a class for itself and says, we have the power, we have the collective power, we can close this system down. We're not going to put up with any just sort of reform and an increase in the minimum wage. We want a radical reconfiguration of how the economy works. That is the kind of politics, I think, that might come out of this situation. But it takes recognition. It takes an understanding of the significance of what they do and the coming together of a collective way of organizing, that self-organizing in that community.
I want to ask you a little bit about the socialist vision of freedom, the radical reconfiguration that you're talking about today.
Well, it's interesting. Marx tries at a certain point to, he's not systematic about this, it's just occasional kinds of commentaries. But one of the questions he asks, he says, what is wealth? And he says, well, the wealthy person is really somebody who has all the basic needs taken care of, and they are free to do what they like with their time the rest of the day. In other words, imagine a society in which your basic needs were taken care of, and you took care of them in, say, 2 or 3 days' labor a week. Then the rest of the time you did what you liked, how you liked, and you socialized how you liked and all the rest of it. So when he says the realm of freedom begins after the realm of necessity is left behind, it assumes that there is a way of organizing the economy to give that kind of freedom. Now, freedom for Marx is, again, about the capacity of individuals in their own situations to do what they please and give license to human creativity of all kinds. The problem is that, of course, the world of necessity has to be taken care of. And that has to be taken care of in a way which kind of is disciplined. So that freedom is not kind of just doing what you like all the time. It's about taking care of basic things and actually being disciplined around those things, and actually, to some degree, being unfree in one part of the economy in order to maximize freedom in the other part of the economy. So freedom is not a total virtue. In fact, of course, what the capitalists say is they want universal freedom because they want the freedom to exploit. Some good freedoms that we want to preserve and allow and all those kind of things. And then there are some very bad freedoms which we want to curb. And those bad freedoms are going to have to be taken care of and disciplined. In other words, we don't want Jeff Bezos to be free in the way he is right now, to buy up all of the newspapers and this kind of stuff. We don't want the kind of freedom that Rupert Murdoch exercises, Fox News. These are the kinds of freedoms which are negative freedoms. So I think Marx's doctrine of this is to say, there are a bunch of bourgeois freedoms which are actually negative. We therefore have to reject them. And in fact, his argument goes something like this. Liberal theory got the matters all the wrong way around. I mean, what liberal theory does is to assume that there is some innate, God-given, some sort of primitive freedom which we have and which needs to be preserved. And of course, the paradox of the liberal theory is that out of those freedoms comes wage slavery, debt peonage, all of the unfreedoms that we currently experience. Marx says it's the other way around. Freedom is something that has to be made in the future. And socialism is about the making of that freedom. And the only way to make that freedom is to actually go through unfreedom in order to get to the kind of freedom. So Marx's view of freedom is a very dialectical one in which the negative freedoms are there. They have to be controlled at the same time as they can also be used to try to take care of the basic necessities so that the real freedoms can be created. So freedom is, instead of being something that was, if you like, a primitive virtue, as it is in liberal theory, Marx kind of says, no, that was not, it was never there. And the, one of the big barriers in the United States to politics right now is a view of freedom that regards it as being so anti-state, so anti-intervention, so anti-collective action, that you can't possibly get to the positive freedoms. And that is, of course, the way in which capitalist ideology has worked very strongly to kind of say, well, you tell me I have to wear a mask, that's a violation of my freedom. You tell me I have to wear a seatbelt, that's a violation of my freedom. You tell me I have to do this, it's a violation of my freedom, I'm not going to do it. And the result is, how many free people are dead right now because that's the way in which the virus kept going. So Marx has that sort of notion of freedom, which is, by the way, is also consistent with the idea that at some time or other, there has to be an authority structure to exist to some way, to control the negative freedoms, and at the same time to organize as systematically as possible what it is that we have to do in order to be actually earn our way to the world of individual freedom of time. Just to go back one other thing, his view is free time is the best measure of freedom. And it's a very interesting thing, because if you say to people, do you feel you have a lot of free time? And the answer is, no, I don't have any free time at all. It's so taken up with, I don't know, arguing with the telephone company about a bill and arguing with the landlord. But, you know, I mean, actually, capital has a very good strategy, which is to make us so damn busy that we don't have time for politics.
You've written about how the pandemic and our responses provide an opportunity to think about how we might build a different society. I'm just going to read something that you wrote and ask you to elaborate on it a little bit. So you write, do we want to come out of this crisis by simply saying that there's 26 million people who need to get back to work in some form of those pretty awful jobs they may have been doing before? Is that what we want? Or do we want to ask, is there some way to organize the production of basic goods and services so that everybody has something to eat, everybody has a decent place to live, and we can put a moratorium on evictions and everyone can live rent-free? Isn't this moment one where we could actually think seriously of creating an alternative society?
It was a very interesting set of events in Britain, for example, where one of the issues that came up with the fact that the schools were not open, the free meals which are given to kids in basically the poorer neighbourhoods of the country were not there. And then the big question was, well, if they're not at school, then they're not going to get fed. And so it took a remarkable campaign by the famous soccer player Marcus Rashford, who became a bit of a folk hero by kind of actually standing up to the British government and saying, you've got to feed these kids. So in a sense, there are always these elements in society where this sort of thing is going on already. And I think the free meals for kids was one of them. And this is, again, the Marxist principles, that you're not going to get a socialist society unless there are elements in the existing situation that can be built upon. And if there were free meals for kids, then you build upon that and say, all right, it's not only free meals for kids. And what we find in the voluntary sector now in the United States is free meals for old age pensioners and the like. So a lot of it is being organized on a voluntary kind of basis. And of course, what we've been seeing is the enormous importance of the food banks and the free restaurants and so on. And you kind of go, well, actually, this is something that could be really pushed into something which is a new configuration in which the food security of the mass of the population is guaranteed. In other words, instead of saying, well, okay, if you need it, you can queue up to try and get the package of food or whatever it is. And actually, again, one of the things that the virus has shown is how much of the population is really, really at the margin, hunger kind of problems. Well, we organize society in such a way that we take what is being done right now and make it permanent. I mean, it wouldn't be too hard to do because it's already there. You'd have to actually embrace a lot of the NGOs and all of those kinds of organizations which are doing actually a pretty fantastic job, that we absorb them, you know, not into some vast bureaucracy, but we try to organize them collectively to kind of say, all right, the aim here is to provide food security. Global hunger is likely to be a real big problem, even bigger outside of the United States than it is in the United States. And I think that we're going to have to see a global initiative that does something of that kind. What we're seeing is something that is going on, and it's working reasonably well in the sense that so far, as I know, we're not finding people dying of hunger in the United States, although many people are very close to it. And probably there are some sectors of the population which are in that situation. No, this is a moment when we can start saying this can be a permanent part of our political and economic heritage.
This idea that capitalism, you write, is too big to fail and too monstrous to survive. I think it's important to kind of think about and unpack what you mean by that. So can you say a little bit more about both, like, what you mean by that and what that means for these kinds of projects like we were talking about in terms of restaurants and meeting human need in terms of food?
I don't think the younger generation would want to be in a situation where it didn't have computers, where it couldn't use the phones and this kind of stuff. And then you sort of ask yourself the question, all right, how is a computer made? And where does it come from? And when you ask that question, you find yourself looking at an extremely complicated commodity chain of component parts coming from all over the world and in the ending up in the mines in Bolivia and extracting lithium or whatever. I mean, so it's a simple like a computer is made that way. And you kind of go, okay, I imagine a socialist society in which everybody would have a computer and everybody would be able to use it. And we can be in communication with each other and we could organize and orchestrate things as is happening with artificial intelligence and all the rest of it. I imagine a society where those things would be available. But we can't naively think that, all right, we can go, you know, tear all of that down and the whole infrastructure. And okay, there's a real problem about the platforms and who owns the platforms and how the platforms are being used. But we can't do without the platforms, right? So my point here was to simply say, look, instead of saying, all right, we want to tear things down and rebuild from the base up, we've got to think about what it is that is going on inside of capitalism right now. And it is extremely complicated, very difficult to imagine how to make a computer. It's not as if you can set up a shop in your backyard and decide you're going to make a computer. This technology and these capacities and powers rest on a structure, economic flows, and employment structures, which if you then kind of say, well, all right, we're going to have each element in that whole kind of long production chain, which starts off in the mines in Africa and India and sort of comes through various forms and ends up right in coming to your front door, that whole structure, what are we going to do? Are we going to disrupt it? Because if any element within that structure gets destroyed, broken down, then we will have no computers. And do we want to live in a world where there are no computers? And my answer to that is no, I don't want to live in a world where there's no computers. The point I was trying to make was that this is a very complex system. Capitalism, it's not all negative. Many aspects of what capital has done has opened the possibility of creativity and the like. So what I wanted to say to people was, well, just don't imagine that you can somehow or other tear it all down and start again. No, what we have to do is we have to think about how to take over the production of computers and the production of electronics and the organization of communication networks. We've got to take that over and then imagine what it would look like as under socialist management. And how radically different would it be? And what we have seen historically is that people have a view that somehow or other it's going to be socialist from the ground up, from the get-go. The answer is no, it's unlikely to be that way. And we have to think, therefore, about, okay, who and how are we going to have a form of political organization that is going to manage the production of communication networks and the production of computers? What I wanted to say was, look, we've got to think about the kinds of things we need to take over and not destroy. And in so doing, we have to acknowledge the immensity and the complexity of the system, which actually lies at the root of our daily lives. And to the degree that we do have something like food security right now, which many people don't, but to the degree that we have it, it has a lot to do with the form of organization that capital has set up. And then we have to think about forms of distribution. How is it all going to be distributed? Here, we've had a virtual revolution through this, the amount of delivery that's going on, and of course, the acceleration of the delivery of goods to people and people sort of calling in and having takeout meals and all kinds of things. All I wanted to do was to kind of say, look, it's very easy to say, oh, we're just going to tear that down and we're going to have a commune here and live happily ever after. It's not going to work that way. And in fact, we've got to deal with these megastructures and take over these megastructures. And there's a great reluctance on the left, it seems to me, to think about the whole kind of question of how do we organize the megastructures so that they provide the infrastructures that will allow us to take care of those basic needs in such a way as to liberate free time for the mass of the population.
You're listening to David Harvey, Smash the Mirror, Imagining a Different System. This is Independent Alternative Radio. Stay tuned at the end to learn how you can get CDs, MP3s, PDFs of this program, and our special Noam Chomsky book offer, Media Control, Achievements of Propaganda. Our website, alternativeradio.org. Give us a call at 1-800-444-1977.
In your initial remarks, you talked about how even before the virus, but increasingly now, capitalism and neoliberalism are in crisis, and we're likely to enter an era into bourgeois reform. So what are the strategies, what are the forms of social organization that the anti-capitalist left should be kind of thinking about so that we end up with more or something other than bourgeois reform?
I sort of like the idea very much of what I would call revolutionary reforms. That is, reforms that open up a path to something which is transformative. Unfortunately, it is often the case that those sorts of reforms open a path and then somebody comes along and shuts the door pretty fast. The public university is a good example of this. I think public university and mass education is a good idea. But as there's a wonderful line in one of Dickens' novels, Mr. Dombey in Dombey and Son says he's all in favor of public education, provided it teaches the people their place. and of course, so we could kind of say, I think higher education is a good thing. I think everybody should have access to come to the university. I got my right the way through to my PhD was paid for by the state, so I didn't pay anything for my higher education. It was all free, and that was because there was a reform of higher education that allowed that to happen. But then, of course, there's a big struggle over, all right, well, higher education is there. What do people learn? And of course, there's been a big battle, ideological battle, in a way, within universities as to whether we teach people radical thinking, or do we just teach neoliberal nonsense? And the answer is, well, we haven't exactly totally lost that battle, but it's an ongoing battle. So, yeah, the reforms, I'm going to support the reforms in exactly the same way, and I hate to admit it, I voted for Biden, and I've been full of self-loathing ever since. But what else? So those are the kinds of issues that arise. And I think that some bourgeois reforms, I mean, if people are hurting, and a lot of people are hurting in this country right now, if there's a bourgeois reform that alleviates the conditions for, say, I don't know, 20% of the US population, why would I stand against it? No, I would stand for it, even though I know that this is a form of co-optation, which is being organized by, you know, Cuomo and his crowd to try and say they're doing the good things and they should be kept in governance in perpetuity. So I recognize all of that. And at the same time, I'm kind of saying, all right, yes, we go for and support the reforms, but in supporting the reforms, we can always find maybe something inside of the reforms which actually allows for something to happen. And in a way, I lived through that in terms of the universities. I mean, there was an opening of higher education in the 1960s, for example, which was really massive. And it was about teaching people to be good corporate citizens. And then there was a revolt, a students' movement of revolt in the 1960s against that. And so we have the movement of 68, and we have a kind of movement that is very much centered in the universities. And so then there's a big trouble for the ruling class in terms of how do they actually deal with this generation of people who've come through with these rather more radical ideas, which are about civil rights, anti-imperialist, anti-colonialist, all those kinds of ideas. And the only way they did that was essentially to say, well, okay, it seems you as a generation, the 68 generation, want two things. You want freedom of choice and you want freedom. And you want justice. And I tell you what, the bourgeoisie effectively said, I'll give you the freedom, you forget the justice. And that's what happened. And that's why I'm a little bit, you know, nervous about too much emphasis on freedom, 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 without a critique of what freedom is about and what kinds of freedoms we want to, go for. So that generation, which was very radical and wanted free speech and wanted free this and free that, got freedom of the market and were given freedom of choice. And entrepreneurialism in the self, the freedom of the self, very attractive idea in some ways. And that's where the neoliberalism came in as a kind of a doctrine of freedom of a certain kind.
Right. I want to bring in a question that we got in the chat because I think it links some of these micro, well, different scales of struggle, let's put it that way. So thinking about what Mr. Harvey said about computers, how do the people who mine the minerals required to build computers get the profits of their labor?
I would hope that the miners would have a collective form of organization in which they would say that they were not going to mine this stuff except for an adequate wage, and that they wanted part of this society where the basic necessities are taken care of and they have a lot of free time. The miners would organize themselves that way. Then you would kind of say, yeah, we here would support that. But in supporting that, notice something. The price of our computers is likely to go up very significantly. And if we go right the way through the production chain and say every single element in that production chain is going to operate on the same principles, that there will be a collective organization which will determine its own wage and will actually determine the price of what it is. By the time it gets to us as computers at the end of the day, it's going to be really very expensive. I mean, right now, of course, we get a lot of the things we get, you know, relatively cheaply because of the Walmart economy, because of the awful conditions of production in China and elsewhere. So, yeah, how does that happen? And to what degree would we, sitting here in the United States, who are using our computers, go out of our way to support and help establish the fact that the people doing the mining of the original materials are adequately and properly paid? I think at this point we have to sort of then say, well, that becomes a very difficult problem to solve by that kind of means. And basically one would want to say there has to be a global form of the economy. And as socialists, we would have to actually have to think about a global form of the economy in which there are certain basic minimum standards. And there have been attempts at bourgeois reform, which is basic minimum standard. One of the tricks, it seems to me, that bourgeois politics played is that the bourgeoisie relies upon the left to actually create the reforms that they want. And so you find yourself actually defending bourgeois reforms in themselves. So you become locked into the bourgeois reforms. I'll support the bourgeois reforms, but I'm not going to animate them. And I would always be wanting to say, look, what we need to be doing is thinking about what kinds of reforms allow us to progress politically. And I think right now, one of the things that's very important on that is the kind of reform which is going to allow us to progress through the organization of that new class which has come into being through the pandemic and was already in formation from the example of the airport and all the rest of it. And if we go different parts of the world, we'll find a different configuration of that class and how that class structure is organized. But just taking the United States right now, how can all of those elements that essentially were in the front line of basic provision of services and goods to the people who were all in lockdown and who were living at home and doing their work from home, how is that class organized? Is it organized? And the answer is it's not well organized. And in fact, the idea that it should be organized is kind of way out there. But are there reforms? For instance, let's suppose that Biden, unlikely, but let's suppose somebody got to him and they kind of said, look, we need to support the reshaping of trade union law and trade union and the rights to organize. And we've got to understand that the forms of organizing that were there in the 1960s are no longer there. We're talking about forms of organizing which are going to embrace precarious labor, intermittent labor, all the rest of it. What kinds of organizational forms can there be? Because labor relations, by and large, are governed by this kind of Fordist conception of who the working class is and what the working class is about. And what we need right now is a complete reorganization of trade union labor law. And if we have that, then if something comes up and there's some mild suggestions along those lines that are coming out of bourgeois, that support it, because that is would could then provide a vehicle by which we could go and actually participate in the animation of the organization of that new class, which is formed around the virus and is forming anyway. And we see some of this in terms of the struggles that are going on. I mean, the struggle in California over the question of are Uber workers workers or are they subcontractors? You know, that's the kind of thing where you kind of go, well, if they are defined as workers, then that makes it a different legal situation. And so that's the kind of thing where I would support it, not because it's going to create the revolution, but because by that redefinition, it allows the possibility of organizing in ways which otherwise would not be there. So that is the kind of thing that I would have in mind.
Mm-hmm. Well, that reminds me that in recent writings, you've also written about how the factory floor has become less central as a site of struggle in the face of financial capital. Or you said this in the Anti-Capitalist Chronicles, and that much of the global protest takes the form of urban rebellion around unmet needs, rather than within the, you know, the factory floor, the workplace proper. I wonder if you wanted to talk about that a little bit.
Well, there's an interesting theoretical point here, which is that which I take from Marx, who kind of says, look, what you see is that in the labor market and in the labor process, there is a class struggle. But when you give the worker money and say, OK, go spend it, then the worker is acting as a buyer, not as a worker. And in the market, the worker becomes a buyer and loses the identity of worker. And Marx is very explicit about that. Now, there is a politics that goes on, of course, in the market over things like, monopoly pricing by drug companies, speculation in housing, and all the kinds of things like that. And people are engaging in struggles over all of those issues. Now, do you say, oh, since this is not a workplace struggle, it's not primary struggle, it's a secondary form of struggle? My answer is no. In terms of the circulation of capital as a whole, there are various points where there's a strategy of struggle. But the class configuration at that point is very different from the point of production. So in production, you have the classic labor versus capital kind of relation. In the market, it's buyers versus sellers. In the financial markets, it's debtors versus creditors. And so you have all of these kinds of different social relations. And the same people can be in very different configurations, which amounts to the fact that class consciousness or political consciousness is shaped by experience in all of those domains, both in the workplace, in the living place, and with the intersection with the credit card companies and all the rest of it. So what that says is the anti-capitalist struggle is going to be actually registered in all three places, but it's registered around a very different mix of people. For example, if there's a struggle against the monopoly pricing in pharmaceuticals, and then it's not only workers who are involved in that, middle-class people are involved in that, all kinds of people are involved in that. And debtors and creditors will come out in a different kind of configuration. So what we have to get used to is the idea that it's the transformation which socialists are looking for is something that's going to have to operate across all of those different identities and all those different experiential worlds which form political consciousness. And if I take Marx's definition or Marx's sense of political consciousness, saying, look, it comes out of material experience. So what's your material experience at the point of production? Well, you understand class relation there. What's your material experience as you go into the supermarket or you go to the pharmacy? Well, it's a different material experience, but it's equally anti-capitalist. So when one of the reasons I talk about anti-capitalist struggle as opposed to class struggle is because very often class struggle is meant to mean only that struggle which occurs at the point of production. And I'm going, no, anti-capitalist struggle is all over the map. And one of the tricks is to actually put it all together. Now, how it gets put all together is kind of interesting. Now, historically, actually, they have often been all together. Union movements were often very, very strong in terms of, you know, intervening in the prices of foodstuffs, intervening in housing and things of that kind. And actually, they were much better agents of anti-capitalist struggle when they linked together the struggle at the point of production and these questions of housing, food security and all the rest of it, so that it became a much more unified field of political struggle.
I want to bring another question in from the chat. It says, you've written that, quote, crises are moments of paradox and possibility out of which all manner of alternatives, including socialist and anti-capitalist ones, can spring. Can you elaborate on this in the context of the COVID crisis? And I know you spoke about it a little bit before, but I'm just wondering if there's anything else you want to say about that.
The fact that Jeff Bezos doubled his wealth in the last couple of years tells you that it's a great moment of opportunity for certain elements within the bourgeoisie. And I think that they see that, and the bourgeoisie is not homogeneous. There are factions of the bourgeoisie who will seize upon a crisis and utilize it. And I think that one of the things that happens on the left is a kind of notion that somehow or other what a crisis is about is an opportunity for the left alone. Well, it's not. It's an opportunity for all kinds of factions to try and advance themselves into a new configuration. And actually, the other point is that the history of crises under capitalism is not to say that they signal the end of capitalism. They usually mean the rebirth of a different kind of capitalism, so that neoliberalism came out of the crisis of the 1970s, New Dealism came out of the crisis of the 1930s. I think we're in a kind of an interesting moment of transition right now, because it's not clear what kind of capital is going to come out of this crisis. In fact, it was always on the cards, it seemed to me, that the neoliberal project would end up being much more authoritarian, connected to neoconservatism. And now I think there's the Trump version of it, which has become pretty much global with Bolsonaro and Modi and Sisi and all these other people, and Orban and so on. So I think that right now there is this kind of question about whether that will be the form of capital which will arise right now. But what is so interesting about the COVID-19 thing is that basically those forms of government, the neo-fascist ones, have not come out of this crisis very well at all. In fact, they've come out of it rather badly. And so if anybody looks and kind of says, well, what kind of governance would we really need to come out of it? Well, it would be something like either the East Asian model, because the Chinese have come out of it pretty well, and so has Taiwan and the South Korea and the like. So we see who's come out of it, and then we kind of say, well, maybe we need a different form of governance. Now, the Chinese case is a very interesting one. And I just want to mention this, because this would probably get people very upset when I say this. But China basically has saved global capitalism twice in the last 15 years. The first time was 2007, 2008, where they had this mass infrastructure program which kind of softened the crash of 2007, 2008 and revitalized the global economy by organizing demand. They've come out of the virus crisis pretty well, and they've now got the economy working again, and they're actually putting demand back into the economy. So for the second time, if you like, they're now saving global capitalism from the collapse. It's very different from this time, but we're close to that. Now, if somebody was sitting on Mars kind of said, whoa, what is the effective form of government on that planet called Earth? And they looked at it and they say the social democracies are a disaster, particularly those which have got to the point of where they're at. Okay, New Zealand is a special case and all the rest of it, but the ones that have come out of it very well have been the East Asian ones, and China's come out of it perfectly well, and it's done extremely well. So what is the form of political economy which is really going to work extremely well in terms of a global model of how to work? And it's the Chinese one. Now, China is a mix of progressive social agenda and authoritarian surveillance kind of politics. And this occurred to me, and I thought to myself, well, you know, there used to be this kind of discussion that went on, it goes back to Rosa Luxemburg and so on, that capitalism is going to end up with a choice of barbarism or socialism. China combines socialism and barbarism in its own political economic project, and it's the only one that's really working well, except that the Chinese are disastrous from the standpoint of greenhouse gas emissions. My point here is that typically what tends to happen in situations of this kind is the world looks around and says, where's the model of government that's really working? And there's a great reluctance, of course, in circles in the United States and elsewhere And there's a great deal of anti-Chinese sentiment right now, but be careful, because that is something which is a very real situation.
We're getting close to time, so let me ask you, someone who's both been teaching for decades and someone who's been thinking and writing and participating in political struggle for decades, what you see both in terms of changing common sense or questions among young people and kind of the hopeful horizons today in terms of contestation and organizing, whether it's in New York or in the United States or around the world.
One of the things that was so interesting about teaching Marx all those years was how the meaning shifted in relationship to transformations that were occurring. And I think that the situation today is really radically different from what it was in the 1970s. It was actually very hard to talk about environmental problems. I mean, you would probably surprise you, but whenever we talked about environmental problems, the conventional Marxist was kind of say it was petty bourgeois romanticism that you were engaged in, and you just wanted to go off and cuddle polar bears or something like that. I mean, I think that clearly there is a much, much more concern with environmental questions. And then, of course, in addition to that, there is what it doesn't exactly add in but complicates matter is the rise of initially of identity politics, which is now, I think, being gone into a more serious kind of integration between sexual identity and all the rest of it. Those issues have become much more pressing. But the result of this is that the map, if you like, of anti-capitalist struggle is much more complicated and much more diffuse and much harder to put together. And when you put it together, also, there are various currents there which are antagonistic to each other. Obviously, I belong to one current which kind of says I'm not anti-government, I'm not anti-state. I think that the taking over the state is still a very important part of what politics would be about. But many other forms of organization are about autonomy, about decentralization, about all those kinds of things. And one of the things I say to people, I say, well, you know, it's so interesting to me that the predominant terrain of left politics in the 1960s was essentially defined by Fordism. So even the opposition was Fordist in its imagination. That is, what it was doing was setting up trade unions, setting up big organizations, having political parties, this kind of stuff. But right now, after neoliberalism, it's the other way around. I mean, neoliberalism has always been about decentralization. It's been about autonomy. It's been about, you know, competition. It's about entrepreneurialism of the self and identity and all this kind of stuff. And we have a left which is actually mirroring it. The left is mirroring that which it wants to defeat and criticize in its form of organization. And I sometimes say to myself, you know, what we should really do on the left is smash the mirror. Because we need to actually get out of the fact that we cannot imagine something which is not actually consistent with the contemporary forms of political and economic organization. So one of the big messages I would want to say is, okay, imagine things are not just simply like neoliberalism with a left tilt, neoliberalism with leftist characteristics, as the Chinese like, as I would call China. We have to think about something which is kind of, you know, radically, radically different. And this is a moment when I think some of that imagination can occur. And I think the virus has created that possibility. And we're not paying enough attention to this. How much food security in the United States right now is actually being delivered in a free kind of way? And where is the resources coming from? And how can resources be mobilized to make that a permanent feature of our social and economic and political life? Why are we not hammering on that right now, saying make that a permanent feature? That is where we should be going.
You were just listening to David Harvey, Smash the Mirror, Imagining a Different System. He spoke in mid-November. David Harvey, professor at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, is a noted intellectual and author. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and progressive and in our 35th year. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.com. alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs of today's program, David Harvey, Smash the Mirror, Imagining a Different System, and for our special Noam Chomsky book, Media Control, Achievements of Propaganda, just give us a call at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can go to our website, alternativeradio.org. If you'd like a free copy of a printed transcript, PDF, or MP3 of this program, just give us a call, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Haymarket Books. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with flamenco guitar virtuoso Paco de Lucia performing Entre Dos Aguas.
Massive robbery of the population for 40 years and has its effects on the way the government works. That's why you end up with, say, 90% of the population being basically unrepresented. And these struggles go on constantly. They're going to go on in the post-pandemic world. It's a radical class struggle, but only one element in the struggle is always fighting, the business world. They're dedicated, they never stop. Unless working people, general population, take part in the class struggle, they're gonna get it in the neck.
That's Noam Chomsky, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Noam Chomsky on class struggle or get it in the neck. The ruling class, and there is such a thing, assiduously attends to its needs, that is to say, to maintain and expand its power and wealth. How does it do that? By manipulation, propaganda, and political influence. It deploys divide and rule tactics to not only distract most people, but goads them to turn on one another. The idea is to get people to look down and not up at those who are on top. So your class enemy is not gazillionaires such as Jeff Bezos or Mark Zuckerberg, but it's the poor guy down the street, out of work, behind in his rent, and his family doesn't have enough food to eat. The boot is on his neck. How to get it off? Organize and resist. Our guest today is Noam Chomsky, the legendary scholar activist who has been a leading voice for peace and social justice for many decades. Chris Hedges says he's America's greatest intellectual who makes the powerful, as well as their liberal apologists, deeply uncomfortable. I talked with Noam Chomsky on November 30th. He was at his home in Arizona, and I was in Boulder. Let's start with the pandemic. Excuse this crude expression, but Americans are dropping like flies, a death a minute. NPR reporting a dire picture around the country. Hospital resources are stretched thin. New York Times headline, As surge spreads, no corner of nation is spared. If this is not a national emergency, I don't know what is. What must be done?
What has to be done is to follow the advice of the scientists and of the countries that have successfully managed it. It is not inevitable. We can see this from the fact that other countries, rich and poor, have handled it pretty well. China, for example, is just back to work. There are very few cases. Vietnam, right on the border of China, almost no cases. New Zealand, basically under control. Australia, pretty much under control. Taiwan, Senegal, Kenya, Nordic countries are not too bad. I mean, there are places that have more or less managed, which tells us, and they're countries of a very diverse kind, which tells us that it is possible, but not without leadership that most of the time even denies that it's happening, which filters down to the population. We've seen reports of people in, say, the Dakotas dying in hospital beds of COVID and telling the nurses that it's all a hoax, it's not happening. You drive around, I stay home, but I drive sometimes. You see people congregating in supermarket malls, no masks, normal behavior. Yes, that's going to happen.
Yeah. What about this notion of what you hear in some circles of individual freedom versus collective responsibility?
Well, individual freedom is a curious idea. I mean, do you have the freedom to drive on the left side of the road if you feel like it? Do you have the freedom to run around a supermarket mall shooting off an assault rifle at random? That's what it means to go to a public event, a public area, without wearing a mask. That's threatening people's lives, seriously. That's not individual freedom. That's unacceptable license. Nobody accepts the kinds of things I described. If you want a choice not to wear a mask, that's okay. Stay home. Don't endanger others.
At some point soon, hopefully, there will be vaccines. But how do we want to come out of this pandemic and attendant economic crisis? The status quo ante?
There will be vaccines. In fact, there are some already that are in pretty advanced stages of testing. The most advanced, as far as I know, is almost unmentionable in the United States, the Chinese vaccine. They're already using it on large numbers of people. That may or may not be good practice. That I'm not in a position to judge, but it's apparently pretty advanced and it's taken seriously by American scientists. We don't hear about it. It won't be available to Americans if it works. There are vaccines being developed here, what's called the Pfizer vaccine, which actually was developed by two Turkish immigrants in Germany, marketed by Pfizer. It's the Moderna vaccine. These may come along. There's an Oxford vaccine. Then comes the question, will people take them? Can they be distributed to the people who need them? Those are open questions. There are policy choices that relate to this. So, for example, there is an international consortium, COVAX, 160 or 70 countries, which have been working on trying to develop cooperation in vaccine development, which is obviously the best way. Data should be shared freely, not sequestered by particular private corporations and governments that support them. Should be shared freely, should be general involvement, there should be no